Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri. Welcoming you again to another in the ongoing series of Personal Democracy Forum's PDF Network conference calls, which are, as always, brought to you by our sponsors at AT&T and the Bivens Group, and we thank them for their support. As you know, this call is being recorded and will later be made available as a podcast on the personaldemocracy.com site. And this week, in our ongoing efforts to really bring you the cutting edge of the kinds of new projects that people are doing to marry new technology and civic activism, we're going to be joined by Jacob Kolker, the co-founder and CEO of The Extraordinaries, which is a project that I've been following pretty closely over the last few months. And really find it, I have to say, extraordinary. It's one of the most exciting ideas I've seen come along in a while, deceptively simple, and all rooted around this concept of micro-volunteering and figuring out how to tap the millions of hours of wasted free time that people have as they travel through their days, and to use mobile technology as the interface for making that time accessible and useful to all kinds of organizations that have some kind of social purpose. So I'll remind everybody again, just as you get on the call, remember to mute your phone and log on to the ReadyTalk interface if you're at a computer so that you can access the chat. You can post questions into the chat. And about halfway through the call, we'll also open everything up and let people voice their questions if they prefer to do it that way. But I thought we'd start out, Jacob, if you would, you know, back us up, take us to the beginning and describe, you know, how did The Extraordinaries come about? Where was the genesis for the idea? And then, you know, how did you get it to the launch phase?
Yeah. Well, let me say thanks to everybody for taking some time out of your day to come hear about our organization, and thanks to Micha for coordinating this and setting it up. So The Extraordinaries really kind of started to come together in April of 2008. One of our co-founders, Ben Rigby, had actually had the kernel of an idea in December of 2007 as he was writing a book chapter about using, you know, a few hours here and there for social good. One thing led to another. We met in April of 2008 and really started, you know, putting this together, bringing ideas around. I had experience with crowdsourcing on political campaigns in my own work history. And as Ben and I sat and really brainstormed and worked through a lot of these different scenarios, it evolved. There wasn't really a aha moment, per se, but it was really an interesting time where for almost a year, you know, we experimented, researched, dug through case studies, examples, really, you know, poured through data, and really started to craft some theories around how to address this problem and move forward. And so, in essence, it still is an ongoing process. And then we were lucky enough to pick up our third co-founder, Sandeep Ahuja, in April of 2009. And Sandeep has had experience helping to launch Kiva. He worked for MySpace and eBay. And the three of us are really driving this project forward.
Mm-hmm. So what's the core idea here? And why wasn't, in some ways it seems so simple, why wasn't it done already?
Well, that's a good question. I think the core idea, and I'll answer that in two parts. The core idea is to take advantage of those moments that we have throughout our daily lives, those transitionary moments where we have a few minutes free when we're waiting for a latte at Starbucks, or when we're riding public transportation on the way to and from work or home, or when we're sitting in a doctor's office waiting room, or when a meeting is 15 minutes late. There are literally hundreds of examples of those moments in our lives where we do have a few minutes free. And the way we utilize that time right now is playing mobile video games, reading the National Enquirer in the grocery store checkout lane, listening to podcasts, probably this one at one point or another.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, and all of those other activities that are designed to kill a few minutes of spare time. And so we look at all of that as a tremendous amount of human energy that we can tap into and provide as value to organizations that could really use some, you know, volunteer labor to move this forward. So that is the essence of the idea. The reason why we, to answer your question as to why it hasn't been done before, I think it really comes down to technology. Crowdsourcing as a recognized and accepted form of organizing human labor really hasn't quite come into its own until the last few years. Wikipedia helped to pave the way for it. Organizations like, you know, Centiv, iStockPhoto, Threadless, you know, have proven the business model around crowdsourcing as an acceptable way of organizing human labor. And it wasn't really until, you know, news organizations started using it for citizen journalism and scientific organizations like Galaxy Zoo, Study at Home, and ClickWorkers through NASA started using it for science, that it started to become an accepted form of organizing, you know, human labor. And so it is that existence of crowdsourcing and the technology that's now capable of coordinating, facilitating 2 minutes of spare time into something of value that really creates the conditions for that to make sense and to work right now in today's society.
And it's the mobile platform, that has matured to the point now where you can put meaty kind of tasks, you can distribute them to people on their phone, right? I mean, the primary idea here is through tapping people where they are rather than expecting them to go to a website, you know, at a PC. That's the other key piece.
Yeah, that's something actually that we've found is interesting. You know, we launched on the iPhone. We looked at the iPhone as an incredibly powerful, rich multimedia device. And, you know, this is a device that, you know, people literally have in their reach within 3 feet, 24 hours a day. And it's not just iPhones, though. I mean, crowdsourcing on regular phones through text messages is something that Nathan Eagle is doing at TextEagle in Africa. You know, as we advance as a society, iPhones certainly paved the way and helped to prove what you can do with a phone and to really move that whole industry forward. And BlackBerry and now Google Android, yeah, I've seen research statistics that say that by 2013, 700 million smartphones will be in circulation worldwide. When you think about those numbers, I mean, that's literally one-tenth of the human population. And so when you marry that with the data that shows that 90% of the world has cell phone coverage, you start to recognize that one-tenth of humanity is walking around in their pockets within a few years with devices that are incredibly powerful tools that can connect them to each other and to large projects, you know, at a moment's notice. And if you can start to harness 2 or 3 minutes of spare time throughout those points of those people's lives, we're talking about delivering the energy, the potential energy of one-tenth of humanity to projects. Now, I recognize that those are big numbers, and nor do I have any illusions about the fact that we're going to even tap one-tenth of that for a while. But it's that potential that exists and the fact that it is already working here in the United States well, where you can use that 2 minutes when somebody's riding on the bus or standing in line at Starbucks, and you can connect that with projects that can use their skills, their brain power, and their human emotions to do tasks. And that's really the key thing, is that, you know, a supercomputer is great, but there is nothing that matches the emotion, the intelligence, and just the general power of the human mind. And if you can tap that for 2 minutes, especially from 100,000 people or a million people, we're talking about a form of energy that hasn't been even possible a few years ago, that now, if coordinated properly, we can deliver to science, to medicine, to all these different entities who could really use that energy and create something magical with it.
So give us a sense of the actual metrics so far. Like, how many people have downloaded the iPhone app, right? It's just on the iPhone now still. So how many people are running it, and what kind of usage are you seeing? And then let's talk about some of the organizations that are, you know, the tasks and kinds of organizations that are on.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me. There was actually one point that I wanted to make a second ago, which is that, you know, it's great that we started on iPhone. We've actually expanded to the web. And, you know, one thing about taking advantage of someone's spare time, you know, we have found that people are using the iPhone. They've downloaded it. And to your question, we've had about 3,500 downloads for our pilot beta. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, we've had 3,300 downloads. We haven't really gone beyond the iPhone yet. But we are on the desktop computers now with a widget, which is really cool, because now when you're bored in your cubicle and you're sitting at work, and you have a few minutes free, we spend as a society 9 billion hours a year playing solitaire. And so when you look at where that's happening, most of it is happening on your desktop computers. And so,
wait, can you say that number again? How long do we spend playing solitaire?
9 billion hours a year playing solitaire.
Just in America?
Those are just government computers, just in the United States.
Wait, so government workers spend 9 billion hours playing?
That's correct.
Good Lord.
Yeah. So when you look at that human energy, it took 7 million human hours to build the Empire State Building. Yeah, and we spend 9 billion a year playing solitaire. And so the mobile is certainly an exciting concept, because it is in everyone's pockets, but what it really comes down to is any interface that we can use to take advantage of someone's spare time and to really harness that energy. And so for us, that's not just on the iPhone. That is also on the desktop computer. It's also going to be in a Facebook app, which we're launching in a couple of weeks, and we'll move over to Android and BlackBerry within a reasonable amount of time. But that is the thing. It's not just iPhone and anymore. We're also on desktops through our web widget, which actually I believe you've embedded in one of your articles. So, to get back to your point about metrics and questions, we've had 3,300 downloads. We launched our iPhone app in March of this year. We launched version 2 in July, and we just submitted version 3, which should be coming out in about 2 weeks. We launched our web widget in July of this year, and already we've seen more usage on the web widget than the iPhone, which is really exciting to us.
You should actually give, now, just for people who don't know, describe the kinds of uses you're talking about, what these little actions are that are adding up.
Yeah, great question. So let me run through just two different types of tasks. What you can do on the iPhone is a little different than what you can do on your desktop computer. And it really comes down to the portable component of a mobile device. So there are two types of tasks that are then facilitated. There are things that you can do that require you to be in the right place. And so those are, for example, taking a photograph of a park and pinging the GPS location, which is something that we're doing for Kaboom. Kaboom is an organization that is mapping play spaces in the United States with the goal of providing a quality place to to play within walking distance of every child in America. And so Kaboom sends their micro-volunteers out and asks them to photograph parks and offer a bit of commentary on the quality of that park so that parents, when they're looking for a place to let their kids play, can access this database and find that. And just this notion that in a coordinated manner, thousands of supporters of Kaboom around the country can go out and photograph these play spaces and add to this crowdsourced map database. That's something that just wasn't possible, really, before we came along, to be able to have that coordinated system ready to go. But that is an example of a right time and place task. You can't necessarily take a photograph of a park riding on the bus, nor can you do that sitting at your desk unless you have a photograph of that computer stored in your hard drive. Other types of tasks are things that are instant, that you can do at any moment in time, whether you're on the iPhone or sitting at your desk. So, for example, there are image tagging. So organizations like the Smithsonian or the Library of Congress have thousands and thousands of photographs that are unarchived. And what the options they have is they could have a team of graduate students or curators go through and archive those photos, adding descriptive qualities to them. Or they can upload that to a Flickr photo set or the Flickr Commons area, and then we can go in there with our micro-volunteers and add tags to those photographs, describing them as blue, water, tree, dog, 18th century, French, whatever descriptive qualities you can add to that photograph, so that instead of simply having a file name, somebody can go in and when they're looking for a specific photograph or looking for a category of photographs, they can type in those keywords and now the photos will start to show up. And so it's this idea of using, you know, the human intuition, knowledge, emotion, understanding, and eyes to look at these photographs. And to help archive them, catalog them, add them to a database. So organizations, you know, your average everyday organization has, you know, thousands of photographs that they've collected over the years that are sitting on hard drives, but yet they still go to iStock Photo and buy stock photography because the notion of digging through thousands of photos to find that perfect thing is a very difficult task. And organizations could upload stuff to our system, and then use their own supporters to go through and archive that, to build that stock photography library. In the process, they get a complete stock photography library, which is archived and cataloged, but also they've been able to engage their supporters, which is really the key thing here, is that organizations struggle so hard to touch people, to stay active and on the forefront of their minds. And people are given really only a few options these days if they want to engage in a few minutes, and that's sign a petition, call your member of Congress, or swipe a credit card. And that's about it. And so the Extraordinaries presents, you know, dozens of new ways for those supporters to touch that organization, to feel closer to that mission, from image tagging to coordinated photography. Translation will be coming very shortly, where you can translate one sentence at a time, and if you have 100 people do it or 1,000 people do it, you're able to translate entire documents and with our system vote the quality up or down and provide, you know, value to the organization while engaging the members. And so those are just some examples of what we're able to facilitate right now, and with translation what we're going to be able to facilitate in a month or so. And some of the other tasks that exist. But you can go to our website, beextra.org, and see a complete list of all the different tasks that micro-volunteers can do in two-minute chunks for a cause or a community that they care about.
Mm-hmm. What's the response been from the sorts of organizations that you're trying to help? I remember when Ben, I first spoke to Ben about this, Ben Rigby, your co-founder, and he wrote a piece for Tech President about the idea and how this was sort of a brave new frontier for volunteer organizations that rely on volunteers, to tap this untapped potential. And he got some pushback from, you know, that sort of surprised me, from people saying, no, this potential really isn't there. Or we're already doing everything we can, and frankly, you know, most social benefit organizations, don't, you know, the best kind of volunteers for them are people who actually, you know, don't pop in and out, but, you know, kind of come in, get trained, and do, you know, sort of intensive, committed work for them. What's your response to that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And there are folks out there that are critical of this, and we appreciate that. So what it really comes down to is a couple of things. One is the notion of what a volunteer experience should be. And we hope here at The Extraordinary is that people will always want to go down to an on-site location, you know, pick up a shovel, commit to, you know, 4 hours or more over the course of a few months. And that is important to society and to staying engaged with the community. But when you look at the numbers and the statistics, for all the talk of service, for all the programs that we have, for everything that exists in the United States to get people to volunteer, when you look at the actual numbers of people that actually do it, it's only 26% of the population. And that includes people that are volunteering 1 hour a year. And those are the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers. Those are not things we're pulling out of the sky. That's actually government research. And so what that means is that the current system isn't working for three-quarters of the population. And when you deep dive into it, when you look through the numbers, when you do the research, it's there clear as day in the Bureau of Labor Statistics survey. 64% of people that work full-time say the number one reason they don't volunteer is because they don't have time. So when you have 60-hour work weeks and kids and errands and the stress of just everyday life, it's hard to find 4 hours to go down to an on-site location, to go to a volunteer organization and give that time, which is why we have these volunteer service days, Martin Luther King Service Day, now September 11th Service Day, where you can plan for it. You can set aside your Thanksgiving to go serve soup at a soup kitchen, and that is your contribution to society. But that doesn't solve the problem, because organizations don't need volunteers on Martin Luther King Day, September 11th, and Thanksgiving only. They need volunteers year-round. And people want to give back. We give $300 billion a year in charitable donations. So there's a desire amongst people. There is a need amongst organizations, but the only opportunities that really exist right now are things that serve the need of the organization, where the opportunity for volunteer exists during the day. It's at, you know, during work hours, oftentimes when people have jobs. There's a long-term commitment because that's the value proposition for the organization. They're not going to invest training and, you know, trust you and give you responsibility unless you can show up on a consistent basis. And so when we come along and we say, well, actually, you can volunteer in a two-minute chunk and, you know, leave, and that's it, it is met with some resistance from organizations that work really hard to build trust and to build relationships with people that can serve their needs in a longer chunk. But with crowdsourcing, when you look at an organization's database and you say, okay, there's 100,000 people in that database, let's say that 10,000 of them can volunteer in micro chunks over the course of a year, you know, you can add up to, let's say, you know, 20,000 hours of volunteer time that pulls from two-minute chunks. That's actually representative of 10 staff members over the course of a year. And when you build a system out that can facilitate crowdsourcing, that can take those tasks broken out from small chunks and put it together into something that has value, that the organization doesn't have to manage, that is vetted, and that has high quality, then you can really make that happen. And so we aren't trying to compete with people that are facilitating offline engagement. We are presenting a new way that is a new way of thinking to people that have been doing this for a while and that presents a new approach, and that isn't as easily received as one might think.
Mm. Okay, one more question, and then we'll see if folks on the call want to jump in with their own. Walk us through, I think we've gotten a sense of what an individual might experience if they were to jump in and micro-volunteer through the Extraordinaries. But take us through what an organization, one of the people listening on this call is thinking, well, gee, maybe my organization can get in on this. What's the process for getting involved? What sort of criteria are you applying as you judge applicants, you know, to get in on the beta? And, you know, where do you think you'll be, you know, six months from now when you're kind of launching this and putting it out in a more open way on the web?
Great question. So what you can do is go to http://signup.beextra.org. That's BEEXTRA.org. And there you'll be able to apply for the pilot program and create an account. And we'd love to have you do that so we can follow up with you and do some research. As for criteria, for us it's, you know, finding organizations that have a great narrative with a good story and a relatively large membership whose work would be a good fit for our platform. We're working with organizations that can help us test it, break it, you know, put it back together again, experiment, and really take the platform to the next level. And so it really comes down to just looking at the organization, the mission, their constituency, and getting a sense if this will be a good fit for something to test with, to launch with, or if it would be better for us to wait a few more months until we open the platform up across the country. And so there's not a real strict set of criteria short of what I mentioned before. And if you're interested in applying to be part of the pilot program, go to signup.bextra.org and we'll see if we can get you in.
But, I mean, if you go to the site, it's clear that, you know, you're talking about particular kinds of uses, right? So if you're an organization that needs translation of text or image tagging or, you know, maybe certain kinds of citizen journalism or, you know, like the Kaboom example, going out and mapping a particular location, those are things that fit nicely onto your platform, right? So from an organizational standpoint, potential groups have to really be thinking, what is it about the work that we do that can be chopped up into little pieces and shared this way, right? I mean, do you give people any guidelines on that, or this is basically, you know, you got to figure it out on your own?
Yeah, great question. So right now I'm working very closely with organizations on a personal level. There are templates that we have which fit nicely with our system. So photo tagging and photo collection are two templates that we have. And then there's also the builder that we just launched, which is really exciting. So organizations can log in and create their own mission the way that they want to do it with the builder. So they can go through, and if they want their constituency or their community to write text or review a web page or you know, ping a GPS location or send an email or whatever, in any combination of those different components in the phone using the camera, the mobile internet, the GPS, the phone, it's that combination of tools that you can create anything you can think of using the builder. And you can tie in your own objectives and your own activities and really run with it on your own. And so, yes, we do have two templates. Yes, I am working with organizations very closely to figure out what works for them, to give them ideas, to help share best practices that we've started to create. But there's also the ability in the system for organizations to create tasks using the builder on their own and run with it.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to get a little more technical on you. How do people get data in and data out? So you have a set of photos to be tagged, or you have
documents that need to be translated into Spanish. I mean, to me, the most obvious use here would be like, you know, help us translate our website into Spanish
right.
or into other languages. How do people get the data in? How do they get it out?
Great. So for photo tagging, they can import a Flickr photo set, and our system syncs back and forth and takes the photos and then sends the tags back. For other types of tasks like photographing, their community sends the photos in, and organizations can go to their profile page or their activity feed and download those photos off of our website. For translation, we're still building it out, but the idea is that an organization can upload a document or import the URL of a website. Our system breaks that up into small chunks. The community translates those chunks. The quality is rated and voted on,
mm-hmm.
and then it's compiled back together and sent to the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the basic principle of the translation task as we continue to shake it
right.
up.
And in both cases, if I'm hearing you correctly, somebody who works, who is not all that technologically savvy, basically, in the first case, if it's a deck of photos, simply a Flickr account will do. And secondly, if it's translate a website, what you seem to be saying is that the extraordinaries will do the hard work of scraping the pages of that site and breaking them into manageable chunks, somehow tagging those chunks appropriately so that when the translations are given
right.
back, the organization has them in some form that, you know, all they have to do is cut and paste.
Right, and so what the first thing we're going to be able to do is from a document. Web pages are clearly,
mm-hmm.
from a technical standpoint, obviously harder to do, and when you get into the different types of structures of websites and the different code, it is a bit more difficult. But from a text document standpoint, that is where translation is going to be as we launch
the
component of it. Yeah.
So upload a document and receive a translated version that's been graded by other users.
Right.
And
that's
is
exactly
hopefully
right.
good enough to use. That will be an amazing achievement, I think. Because I think there are many, many organizations that simply never get past maybe a translation of their homepage.
Right.
Simply because it's expensive
and
you know, they all have limited budgets.
Yeah.
So.
But what's really exciting is that it is expensive and they do have limited budgets, but they also have people in their community who speak another language, who speak Spanish, and who want to help that organization. And,
mm-hmm.
and so we can, you know, in a win-win, engage those supporters while, you know, providing real value and saving money to the organization. That is the essence of why we exist.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about how you're funded, how you pay your bills, or what the plan is to pay your bills.
Yep. We have been generously supported by the Knight Foundation.
Uh-huh.
We also won an Echoing Green Fellowship this year, which is a social entrepreneurship fellowship. We've also won several other competitions, including an Ashoka Changemakers Award, which is part of the We Media Conference, NetSquared, which is part of TechSoup Global, and United Nations World Youth Summit Award. And it is the combination of all of those, you know, different cash prizes and the support of those communities that have really been able to let us spread our wings and fly.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us time to experiment, to prove out a business model, and to move the organization forward.
Mm-hmm. Two more questions, and I'm going to see if anybody on the call wants to jump in. So, folks, if you have a question, you know, unmute and ask, but I'm going to keep talking. My first question is there any organization or cause that you would block from using the platform? I mean, is there some sort of filter? I'll give you my worst-case example, you know, I don't know, the British National Party comes to you and says we want to, you know, get our members involved in tagging photographs of, you know, or in crowdsourcing whether people are here in the country illegally. I don't know. I mean, you know, you can think of things that are politically charged. So is there some sort of a filter, or is the idea to just be an open platform for anybody to use?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think that there's a basic common sense understanding of what is, you know, racially or politically acceptable from just a normal, you know, what is or is not something that should be tolerated in the public space. So we, of course, will not allow racism or anything that's sexually explicit or whatnot on our system. That's the first thing. The second thing is, there's twofold. One, we are going to have a flagging system in our system, on our platform, so that in the event that something is disturbing or is clearly not acceptable, if somebody comes across that, they can flag it, and we'll immediately review that and decide whether that's acceptable or not. But at the end of the day, we are a platform, and much like Facebook can't necessarily go through and patrol every group and every page, it's not something that we really feel that we can do either. And so we will choose to highlight the sides of the platform that are acceptable and that are, you know, worthwhile and whatnot. But as we do open up, there is going to be the ability for people to use it as they see fit. And I don't necessarily think it makes sense for us to sit there with a gavel and decide whether or not every application comes through makes sense for it to exist on our system. So we'll continue to do the best that we can to follow the law and to be respectful when it comes to things that are racist or sexually explicit and your basic litmus test of what's acceptable or not. But beyond that, it does get a little tricky and something we're going to have to figure out moving forward.
And the fact that you're a grantee of the Knight Foundation, if I'm not mistaken, that means that your code has to be open source. Is that true?
That's correct.
So somebody, in theory, you know, the code is sort of being given to the world.
That's correct. Within, you know, up to the grant of the Knight Foundation. You know, open source is something that we're certainly exploring. It's something that we care very deeply about just because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're still figuring that out as well. And so the Knight Foundation has given us a grant, and we intend to make everything that we've built with their funding open source. You know, as much of whatever else we can as well.
And I see that from the story that NPR did on you that you're planning to become a B Corporation. What does that mean? Social entrepreneurial enterprise that plans to make money by charging organizations a per-task fee. So you're not a nonprofit.
We are not a nonprofit. But we do care very deeply about the social impact of our work, which is why we got into this space in the first place. And so a B Corporation is essentially a commitment to be audited, to ensure that your stakeholders are at the table with your shareholders and your funders. And that basically means that we can make decisions that are in the best social interests of our community alongside the best interests of our shareholders. And so B Corp, you know, is something that is an emerging stamp of approval, if you will.
Is that a California form of organization? It's the first time I've ever heard of it.
So it's not an actual tax structure. It's a certification, much like fair trade, for example. But it is something that major corporations have embraced and moved forward with. I mean, at one point, Ben & Jerry's was a B Corp. Shore Bank, which is a $3 billion environmental development bank, is a B Corporation. Hanson Bridget, which is a law firm here in San Francisco, is a B Corp. And it basically, again, means a commitment to uphold a certain social mission with your work and to ensure that the voices of your stakeholders in your community are brought into account at the boardroom table along with the interests of your shareholders. And it's a way for us as a for-profit to ensure that we stay true to our social mission and we continue to focus on impact as well as profits.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, well, I'm going to, we don't have that many people on the call today and they're being quiet, so I'm going to just give folks a chance if anybody wants to unmute. It's often the case that they do not, which is totally fine. Jacob, is there any other, we've covered most of the terrain, I think, pretty well. I mean, is there any other efforts like this that you think people should know about? It's often a good thing when you have competition in a space. It shows that you're not the only people with a crazy idea. So are there any other projects like this out there that we should be paying attention to?
Mm-hmm. There are folks out there that are doing great work when it comes to crowdsourcing. Nathan Eagle with TextEagle is a fantastic example, where he delivers the 20-second explanation is that people in Africa make $1 a day, and when you have a word that needs translation, say Swahili, for example, you can get up to $1, $1.50 per word from translating that into English and back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is that through text messages, you can deliver, a word or a sentence that needs translating, and somebody in Africa can translate that sentence from Swahili into English or back and forth and, quadruple or more their income for the day or for the week even through a simple task like that. So TextEagle, which is TextEagle, is a great example. There's also folks like Samasource, who is helping to bring crowdsourcing to folks in Africa, where people can do that. Mechanical Turk is a platform run by Amazon, which pays workers to do small human intelligence tasks, and that has and continues to be a major source of revenue for or of saving money for corporations around the world. So there are many tasks out there that require human intelligence to complete, many computer tasks, and Mechanical Turk facilitates that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people in the social gaming space which are doing great work. Recapsule in the business world, Google just bought ReCAPTCHA. And what ReCAPTCHA does is delivers, old New York Times articles to people creating accounts or signing up for Ticketmaster through those little things you have to type in to prove that you're a human being. And that's an actual image of an old New York Times article that people are digitizing in the process of proving that they're a human. And I think 100 million times a day, one word, two words are being digitized 100 million times a day, and
mm-hmm.
bringing entire decades of the New York Times into the public domain to make them searchable. And so there are dozens and dozens of examples out there of crowdsourcing being successful both in the social space in the business world. We're trying to bring it home for communities.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing. Well, I'm. What I'm going to do is I'm going to let the call end a little bit early because I don't. I personally don't have any more questions. And given that time is precious, and you've just proven as well how precious and valuable it can be, I don't want to waste your time either, Jacob. So last chance if anybody who's still listening wants to chime in. We'll give you a few seconds, and if not. What we're going to do is thank Jacob Kolker, the co-founder and CEO of The Extraordinaries, for updating us on this really exciting project. Jacob, I expect that we will check in from time to time and keep the PDF community well apprised of what you're up to, maybe get you to present at the conference next year. It's really great work. I want to thank AT&T and the Bivings Group again for sponsoring the PDF Network calls and helping make this whole community possible. We will see you again in 2 weeks. I think the call is with Katie Esquivel on the Latino community online, how its contours are changing, and how to engage Latinos online for your cause. So we'll see you then, and until then, we will see you online. Thanks again, Jacob.